Motors! Start your engines!
Hit the pace car! What for? Because you hit every other damn thing out there, I want you to be perfect!
When I'm driving, I got a guy on the radio who talks to me. You can see him. He talks to me.
He didn't slam you, he didn't bump you, he didn't nudge you, he rubbed you. And rubbing sun is racing.
Hey race fans, welcome to the Hoobazoo Radio Network, and welcome to Drafting the Circus. My name is Frank Santoroski. I'll be your host for the next hour as we go over the weekend racing. Before we get to that, let me introduce you to the panel I have assembled tonight. I have with me Mr. Gray Warren from Richard Childress Racing, race engineer Richard Uden, and the NASCAR correspondent from Motorsports Tribune, Seth Eggert. How is everybody tonight?
Doing good.
Fine.
Very good, thank you.
All right, well, good to have you guys on. It's always good to talk to you guys once a week. It's the highlight of my week. But this week,
I feel so sorry for you.
Oh, Richard. So, but anyway, we've got a special show lined up for you tonight. I have also with us tonight, we have a special guest. We have Mr. Christopher Hinchcliffe, who is the author of the book Chasing Checkers, and the sequel to the book was released yesterday, which would be Wednesday the 18th, and you'll find it in Amazon, and then later on you'll find it in Barnes & Noble and all these other online retailers, as well as you can order in the bookstore. The sequel is called Chasing Checkers Acceleration, and the book is inspired by Chris's baby brother, who you may have heard of from the IndyCar series, James Hinchcliffe, who won 2 weeks ago in Iowa. And we're going to talk about the book and the writing process and the new book. But welcome to the show, Christopher.
Well, thanks very much. It's a real pleasure to be here.
Absolutely. So before we talk about the book, let me just knock out the headlines real quick. So IndyCar was in Toronto. Scott Dixon took the win, as some of his rivals took themselves out or took one another out, but that kind of opened the door to a very popular third-place guy in the podium, Robert Wickens, who's from the immediate area, and right behind him, your little brother, James Hinchcliffe. So we had Canada 3-4. It would have been nice for a 1-2 or a 2-3, but hey, you know, not bad at all for the hometown boys. NASCAR was down in Kentucky with a very calm, clean race at Kentucky, where Martin Truex dominated and took the win there. So with that being said, Christopher, so the book Chasing Checkers, I want to just real quick throw out my impression of the book, okay? I'm an avid reader, but I generally don't read fiction. I tend to read a lot of biographical stuff or historical stuff or whatever, but I purchased your book on the Kindle. I downloaded it. As I started to read it, I got a little lost in the beginning until I realized, he's alternating the timeline between flashback and current action. But once I got the rhythm of the book, it just sucked me into the story. And I read it all the way through the end, and believe it or not, towards those final chapters there, I was physically cheering at my Kindle, saying, "Man, go get him, Teddy, get him, Allison." Yeah, so I mean, the book is that captivating. I thought it was fantastic. So I want you to kind of give us the background of how you first thought of the idea to write the book. Obviously, there's some inspiration from your brother. So let's just real quick, the background on the book, where you got the story from and how you decided to go ahead and write.
Well, look, first of all, Frank, I mean, thank you so much for saying that. I, I might say off the bat, you aren't the only person who had a little issue with the time shifting right off the bat. I guess I didn't signal that quite well enough, but it's really, really nice to hear that that it sort of grabbed you the way it did. So thank you for saying so. The idea for the book, I gave a few talks at some libraries in Indianapolis when I went down for the races this month. And I sort of told the story behind the book a little bit. And I mean, for me, I spent most of the last decade basically in graduate school and teaching law and philosophy, mostly over in England. And you know, it was late in my sort of graduate career when my brother had his big accident. And it was one of these moments when you realize that you sort of take stock of things. And I realized that, you know, my whole family was on the other side of the ocean, and they were all consumed basically with James's career. And, you know, I had kind of been off doing my own thing. And so when the accident happened, I was like, oh man, I got to find a way to connect with this, but I can't, you know, I can't participate in the racing or anything like that. But James has this great story. And all the drivers have these great stories that a lot of people don't see because they just, you know, they focus on the racing or the drama with, you know, getting contracts and whatever. But to me, it, you know, what I know is I know the kid. I know the guy who came up through go-karts and Formula Atlantic and all this kind of stuff before he got to the big race. And I thought, you know, there's a great story there to tell. You know, I had a break between teaching and writing and stuff. And I thought, oh, I'm gonna give this a shot. And that's sort of where the book came from.
So I want to ask you this: as I read through the book, right? Number one, it's quite an easy read. The technical jargon is to a minimum. The length is not epic, but the characters, the main characters, are teenagers, right? And you've done a great job of, you know, kind of capturing how those teenage boys, when they get together, are goofy and whatnot, and not sure how to act when a, you know, pretty girl walks by and whatnot. And it's, and as I was reading all this, I'm thinking, you know, this story would really appeal to young readers, you know, and if we know anything from, you know, Harry Potter and Percy Jackson, that the young reader market is huge. Is there anything sales data wise that kind of tells you who's buying the book, and have you captured this market?
You know, I mean, I made a conscious effort to you know, make it accessible to sort of as wide a range as possible, because I knew initially that, you know, being a first time author, I was basically looking at people who were going to be attracted to it primarily because of the racing connection or the James connection. You know, I had designs to capture a wider audience. The surprising thing to me was that it's actually all ages. I mean, I get you know, parents and, you know, who read it with their kids emailing me, and then I get, you know, 65-year-olds who like to watch the races at home, and they get it, and the people who come up at the signings at the races, it really just runs the full range. It would be hard for me to say, you know, which demographic is sort of gravitating it towards it the strongest, which in a way is, you know, it's really, it's really a nice thing to learn. But, one of the things I learned subsequent to writing the book, was a little bit more about, sort of the struggles that IndyCar is having in a way of growing as a spectator sport. And, you know, I have these great pie in the sky kind of dreams of, well, you know, maybe if we can get this book to people who are readers but not necessarily race fans, maybe we can turn some of them into race fans too. I don't know, but yeah, no, it's sort of run the whole range.
Yeah, that's a good point you make, that you can, you know, maybe turn readers on to being race fans, because actually, if you read the story, you don't have to be a race fan to like the story. I mean, there's a lot of intrigue, there's a lot of drama. You know, Teddy, the main character, is a very complex character. You know, he's got this, you know, without ruining the book for anybody else, he's got this secret about his past that's been held from him that he finds out right before the biggest moment of his life, and he's got to deal with that. You know, and then he meets Allison, who's knows more of the secret than Teddy does himself, and he's got to deal with that. So there's a lot of emotions going there, and it's just, I mean, you don't even have to like racing to like this book, but I mean, if you do like racing, it's twice as good. But yeah, I wanted to ask you, when you write, okay, what's the environment you like to write in? Do you like to just hole up in a corner of the house and tell everybody else to be quiet, or do you like a little distraction behind you, or do you write like me and have 15 tabs open on your browser while you're looking stuff up?
No. For me, writing is definitely a solitary pursuit. I typically write at home, on my own, you know, in an office, at a kitchen table, whatever. Occasionally, maybe if I'm doing some editing or something, I'll go to a coffee shop, but, you know, I'll put in some music. I don't like having people around. It's, you know, I'm lucky, you know, I was either living alone or I was working alone. I was living with my girlfriend who was away from the house, the time I was writing most of it. So I would definitely take those hours when I was on my own. For me, it was very much I had to like be alone with the laptop to get it done, for sure.
All right. Now, Seth, you've got a quick question for Christopher.
Yes, I do. First off, while writing as part of the process for some of the scenarios, as far as, say, some of the accidents that take place that you describe in the book, did you ever run any of them by James to see if they were realistic situations that could happen in racing, whether it's the go-kart that, without ruining too much of the book, runs up Teddy's back in one of the flashbacks, or even the penultimate crash towards the end?
Yeah. Great question. So I'll sort of give two parallel answers here. The first is to say, and this is to address a question that everyone always has, which is how much of the story is true. And the answer is the overarching story is fiction. Obviously, you know, we learn right off the bat that that Teddy is adopted. You know, his parents are divorced. He has one sibling. You know, none of those things are true about James. And all the stuff we learn about the secret past, that's all sort of false. But a lot of the scenes in the first book are actually just taken directly from things that happened in James's experience going up through the ranks. So the one scene, the go-kart riding up on his back, that actually happened. That is actually something that happened to James in I don't know if it was his first season exactly, but it was you know, it was early on in his go-kart career, and that almost scuppered the whole thing, because, you know, as soon as that happened, my mom was like, that's it, we're done, this is not happening anymore. We're not putting him on one of those vehicles ever again. But so that, you know, that's that part. And the other thing is, I mean, James read and signed off on both books. He was my technical consultant on both books, and he made great suggestions in both cases. The one thing in the first book that he made the most he gave me the most feedback about was actually there's one race or one scene that takes place racing in the rain, and he said to me, he's like, you know, Chris, this is great, but you know, you really need to you need to explain to people that racing in the rain is the most terrifying thing you can ever do. It is, you know, you can't see anything, you have no idea what's going on around you, the spray, everything is white out, it's absolutely terrifying, and you need to beef that section up. So I mean, James wasn't involved in sort of the writing of the initial drafts, but James definitely signed off on both drafts before anyone else saw them, and he was the one who was making sure that I hit those sort of technical points. So I mean, there's a couple accidents that are maybe slightly more fantastical than you might expect, but then again, I saw a car leap over the back of another car and do a barrel roll in Toronto this weekend. So, you know,
yeah, that was wild.
That was quite the Star Mazda race. Yeah, I don't know if have you guys seen the clip of that one?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, yes. Yeah. I was terrified, and I was so glad that the driver was okay. Yeah, that was, and we've seen that sort of thing in racing, and you know, James has had you know, his wreck at Indy was nearly, you know, nearly took his life. I mean, it didn't look that bad on camera, but then when you heard the story, and I heard him tell the story of that, and you know, just an amazing, you know, story of recovery. So,
well, but this is the thing. I mean, both about, you know, the thing about James's wreck and you know, about writing about racing, you know, writing fiction about racing. I mean, the thing about James's wreck is, I remember I got the call. I was in England, and my mom called me up because, you know, it was a practice, so I wasn't watching or anything. My mom calls me up and says, James is in the hospital. My first thought is, oh, okay, Mom, she overreacts, whatever. So then I look up the video, and I see the video of the crash, and I thought, meh, I've seen worse, right? It didn't look all that spectacular a crash. It wasn't until days later that I really got the full picture of it. But and the other thing is, I mean, the reality is there's on a weekly basis, there's really only a handful of incidents that you typically see on a racetrack. I mean, you do get, you know, once a year, you maybe get something really fantastic, but for the most part, the crashes more or less are predictable because all the drivers, you know, they know what they're doing. So the kinds of mistakes that are even possible or likely to happen are fairly limited. So it's true that when writing fiction about these things, if you do, you know, first of all, I try to be a little bit careful with putting too many accidents in because, you know, it becomes a bit of a gimmick. But, you know, after a while, you can't just keep having the same thing happen. So you have to try to make them a little bit, you know, a little bit different every time, even if it, you know, is unlikely. The nice thing is in both of these books, these are still fairly young drivers that we're dealing with. So so the possibility of them making more dramatic mistakes leading to more dramatic incidents, in my opinion anyway, is a little more believable.
Absolutely, yeah. So now I wanted to ask you this real quick because I want to circle back to the, you know, the conversation about maybe the book will help get folks on board with IndyCar. In the book, you refer to the AmPro series and the AmPro 500 and the AmPro Light series, which is obviously IndyCar. Is there any particular reason that you didn't? Is that a copyright thing, or did you just want to make sure it was fictional? Because I would personally think that if you had reached out to IndyCar and say, "Hey, can we use your name?" that they might have been on board with that. Or is it just a writer's thing to make it fictional?
Do you know, the initial reasoning for that was, and you have to remember, I mean, this was something I wrote initially just kind of as a bit of a laugh. I didn't know how seriously I was going to take it in the end. So part of the reasoning was, you know, I wasn't sure if I was going to be able to use the proper names or anything, but also, I wanted to create enough of a gap that if I needed to, I could you know, make up rules. I could fudge the technical specifications of the cars. I wanted to allow myself a little bit of license creatively, rather than making sure that I was going to have to go and read the IndyCar Bible every time I wanted to talk about something that was happening in a race or at a track. In the second book, you know, after the first book, you know, the way it was received, I decided that I wanted to take a step back towards realism. So in the second book, for instance, there's you know, all the tracks that they race on are real tracks, and I use their names, and I try to pull a little bit more of that realism into it. But I was already sort of committed to the fake series, the fictional series that I'd created in the first book. So I'm hoping there's a bit of a balance there. But honestly, it was just to allow myself the freedom to sort of make things up without having to call up the race stewards to make sure I wasn't getting involved in an incident.
That actually makes a lot of sense. That's the perfect answer to my question. Yeah, it makes sense. So, but let me ask you this. So, years ago, to get a book to press was a very daunting process. Yeah, you had to commit to so many copies of a hard copy before they would even let you do a paperback, and then they would put this clause in your contract that if the books don't sell, you have to buy them back. Now, in the digital age, right, and this, it's a little more convenient for a writer or a filmmaker or even a musician to kind of get their product out to an audience, you know, maybe not as big an audience as you would get with Simon & Schuster. But can you just kind of like maybe give us a little advice for writers that are trying to, you know, get their first publication and how to get it out there?
Absolutely. No, I mean, the decision for me to publish independently was it was really a no-brainer. I mean, to go through the traditional publishing process, which is still quite arduous and still worthwhile, you know, depending on what you're looking for, it didn't make sense for me because, you know, I knew that initially I was going to be marketing to an audience that I kind of already had access to, you know, through social media and stuff with James and everything like that. And, you know, my expectations were very, very minimal. I wasn't trying to, you know, write the next, Harry Potter or anything like that. So for me, it was I'm gonna write something and put it out there. So I was very lucky, and not every author is going to have that going in. So you really have to you have to clarify for yourself what your goals are. If you're looking for if you're writing a literary novel, let's say, you know, and you want to be reviewed by the big reviewers and in the journals and all that kind of stuff, you really have to go the traditional publishing route, and that involves finding an agent first, and that agent is going to connect you with a publisher, and you're going to get rejected for 2, 3, 4 years probably before you finally get a deal, and then maybe it won't go anywhere. And even then, you're probably going to have to do tons of self-promotion. If you want to go the other route, and this is true if you're doing genre fiction, maybe you like to write mystery novels, or you like science fiction, adventure novels, or something like that, right now is a great time to be writing that kind of stuff because of the way you can now put your work out there. You could, you know, you publish it with Amazon or you know, any of these other web-based companies that will help you distribute it. Getting it actually sort of ready to print, or, you know, if it's an ebook, you can just start with an ebook. Lots of people, I mean, the electronic book market is growing every year. You don't even need to worry about print costs and things like that. But the key is, you know, you can't just think of yourself as an author if you're going to go that route. You have to be prepared to be a marketer as well. Now, again, in my case, I had a bit of an advantage because I already had some help. You know, I had some help from my brother. But, you know, I in the last, especially leading up to the second book, you know, you have to look into the ways you invest in advertising with Facebook or with Amazon. But there's so many resources out there online now to help you with that. I mean, if you want to give it a shot, I mean, I really do think now is a great time for people to do it. I mean, that's kind of a short, superficial answer. I mean, there's all kinds of details you could go into, and anyone is very welcome to send me an email and I can tell them what I know and point them in the right direction. But, you know, these days, so many great editors are working freelance, cover designers, there's all the resources that a major publishing company has, an indie author has access to now. And as long as you take the right steps and you treat yourself as a publisher and you take your own book seriously, you know, there's no reason you can't make a great novel. And, you know, with a bit of luck and a bit of marketing, there's no reason you can't have a huge success on your hands as well. But at the end of the day, you know, if you're going to write, you're going to put it out there. You have to do it because you enjoy doing it. You know, you can't expect success. You can't bank on it or anything like that. Because along with the ease of publishing comes the proliferation of authors who are out there playing the same game. So it's more competitive now than ever on the indie market, to the point where, you know, it's competitive to sell the books that you put out yourself, or it's competitive to get that publishing deal that everyone wants. So either way, you know, you're kind of in it now. There was maybe a period a couple years ago when, you know, the indie market was a little bit smaller and there was a bit more of a Wild West. You know, maybe the chances were a bit better. But nowadays, you really just, you know, it's kind of a gamble either way. So you just have to be clear on what your goals are, I think.
That's great advice. Just be clear with your goals. I like that. So I want to ask you about my favorite quote in the book. Okay. This is my favorite line in the book. It says, And it comes from Greg, the racing instructor. He says, because there are so many variables in racing, the possibility of miracles is higher on a racetrack than in any other form of sport. Is that something that you came up with on your own, or is that something that maybe James helped you with, or somebody else had come up with? Because that line is so true in racing, and I read the book twice, and still that line sticks out to me.
Oh wow! Okay, it's funny. I mean, that's I really liked that line, and actually you're the first person who's pulled it out there for me. Honestly, that is something that, I want to say came from me. It was not something that anyone sort of told me. The reality is living in a racing family, I may have heard versions of that or just sort of absorbed that kind of wisdom through osmosis. But the reality is I've been watching my brother go through this thing. And I mean, I say on the racetrack, or Greg says on the racetrack in the book, but this comes up a lot more in the second book. It's just as true in the off season with getting rides and finding sponsors and this, the amount of things that can go right or that can go wrong and can go right. Like I don't want to say it's all luck or anything like that, but you really don't know. You really don't know. Anything can happen. And, you know, everyone I'm sure listening and certainly all you guys, you know, have seen enough races. You all have probably a dozen moments where that you can remember where you're just like, I can't believe that just happened. You know, everything's going along. You think you've got the next half of the race figured out. And the next thing you know, everything has changed. You know, everyone who was on the top is on the bottom. You've got Alex Rossi from the back with his foot on the clutch and no gas left, crossing the finish line at 100 miles an hour, winning the Indy 500. Like, it's just anything can happen. Anything can happen.
Yeah, so, but I just, like I said, that quote from the book from Greg sums up racing in a nutshell. And it's like, it's, man, if that's all you are brilliant.
No, you are too kind, sir. Too kind.
Oh yeah. Now, Seth, you have another question for Chris?
I do. As you mentioned, you were in a racing family with James Racing. I'm just curious if you left any hidden homages honoring people in racing, whether they were drivers, owners, mechanics, because there were some passages in the book, say the red gloves. Frank and I were talking before the show. We were both picturing, say, Greg Moore, and also some of the names we pictured, Graham Hill and some others.
There absolutely were. So Greg Moore definitely has, again, not wanting to spoil things about the book, those who have read it, you know, sort of know why the red gloves are important in the story. And the reason they're important in the story is obviously not exactly the same, but it's very, very similar in a way to why they are in fact important to James. Of course, James wears the red gloves in honor of Greg Moore, who was a huge hero of his, you know, another Canadian driver, you know, died too young. That was a very, very conscious decision. And there are a handful of references throughout. I'm going to have to confess, I'm by no means a motorsports expert in my family. But, you know, it's impossible to sit around the dinner table as many nights as I have, hearing everyone else talk about, my dad and my brother go on about racing and not pick up a few things. If you think it's a reference, then you've probably caught something. Although I have to say, there's a few people who have said that I seem to have made references that I don't realize. So again, it's possible that they snuck in there subconsciously, or that I picked up by osmosis or something. But the red gloves, I mean, that's definitely one of them. And a lot of the characters, even a couple of the drivers that Teddy competes with. Are, let's just say they're compilations is the wrong word. What's the word I'm looking for? They're sort of packaged characters based on people that maybe James is racing against now or has raced against in the past. So, you know, people can look for things like that if they want as well.
Yeah, you've got the great rival right there with the guy whose dad's a Formula One champion.
And yes.
The dad comes in and everybody in the room stands up and, oh, well, that's a, so, yeah.
Yeah.
So, but speaking of characters in the book, my favorite character in the book is the Russian mechanic Maxim. I think he's, for me anyway, the most fleshed out character in the book. And when I say that, I mean, it's like when I read the bits about Maxim, I can see him in the blue overalls and larger than life man here, slapping Teddy on the back and almost knocking Teddy down and say, oh yeah, you'll be get him next time. I want to know, in the sequel, do we see Maxim some more, or is he...
I get that reaction a lot. A lot of people love Maxim. I love Maxim. He was one of my favorite characters to write and to work with. In the second book, he has a slightly smaller role. He is definitely in there. Again, there's some, you know, potential for spoilers, but he definitely makes a comeback. It's one of those things that if I were to go back and write the second book again, I might try to find a way to make him a bigger part even than he was in the first book, because I know how much people liked him. But without wanting to commit myself or give too much away, I have tried to leave space for a third book, and you can be sure that of the handful of characters who I'd like to continue working with, he'd definitely make the cut.
Excellent. I'm going to say he's a fantastic character. So now Seth and I were talking earlier that we kind of thought that the Chasing Checks would translate well to film, but at the same time, you know, Hollywood has a horrible reputation of making great racing movies. There's only a handful of really good racing movies, but have you ever thought about what Chasing Checkers look like as a film, or even a direct to Netflix, something like that, or do you just prefer to keep the written word?
No, I would actually love to see what someone would do with this on the screen. And I've mentioned it. I have a couple of friends who work in that industry, and we've sort of thrown back ideas about how to maybe, you know, float that possibility to people around there. I mean, the one thing that maybe Chasing Checkers or a story, you know, and, you know, based on that book kind of has going for it is that, you know, most racing movies, you know, are centered around, you know, professional drivers that are already there. It's either a redemption story or it's a big championship. They're all pros. They're very adult. I think that, you know, having something with a bit more of a teen drama kind of side might be easier to put into a film that could appeal to a wider audience. I mean, it's like you said. I mean, I tried to make the story not entirely focused about racing, but also about what it's like to be a racer or someone trying to be a racer. Oh, it's like the characters, you know, or at least the character of Teddy. I mean, he's not yet a professional racer. You know, it's not yet his whole life. And so in that sense, it might translate well into a film. It's really a story about a young man who wants to be a driver. It's not a story about a driver who's trying to win a championship or, you know, who's trying to prove himself against a better driver or something like that. So that's my, that's my thought, but I'd love to see it on screen. Why not?
Yeah. And the funny thing is right now that we were talking about the book industry is a little more open to, with other avenues. So is the film industry. 'Cause you've got all these, You know, I have a daughter who's 13, and she will watch anything that's a Netflix original series. You know, if they made it a Netflix original series, she'll latch onto it, whatever it is. You know, whether it's Teddy in a Race Car or you know, Kids in a Classroom, and there's just a wider audience, or it's just easier for somebody to get their product out there to the masses. And you know, whether it's successful or not, yeah, we don't know. So, but now, Richard, you want to chime into the conversation, and you've got a question for Chris?
Yeah, two questions really. Firstly, just purely on interest, you said you're living in the UK for a little while. Where in the motherland were you living?
I was living in Oxford since you asked.
Oh, okay, yeah, that's not far from where we lived in Bicester.
Oh, right. Okay, yeah, not far at all.
Yep.
Where
yeah, there you go.
The outlet mall.
Oh, don't even talk to me about that place. Anyway, yeah, sorry, everybody. That's a completely personal conversation.
Yeah, that's between y'all. I have no idea.
On sort of, you know, more of the concept of publishing a book, because it's something that I've got a huge amount of respect for people that can do this sort of thing, because I've got no sort of writing ability to that level to of any extent. But what's it like when you actually publish a book on the day when it gets published? Are you sort of like checking all the, you know, its charts on, you know, the Kindle charts and the iBook sort of store and all that sort of stuff? Or is it, don't you get that instant feedback from it?
So for the first one, it was definitely like that. You know, I had the launch all planned out. It was supposed to basically time up with the start of the race season last year. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I called up my editor and I had a, you know, a bottle of wine at the ready. And I'm like, all right, let's go. And, you know, we sent out the blast. Okay, book is live. You know, and I'm checking. And for the next few days, I'm checking every 5 minutes, hitting refresh, looking at the Amazon ranking, checking my – I had a distributor that sort of – track the ebooks, and I was checking that, and it was great. This book was a little bit more it was more of a slog, both the writing, the editing, and then finally the publishing than the first one. And you know, at today, you know, so well, say I guess yesterday for the listeners, but you know, when I was finally announcing that the book was live, I sent an email to my mail list. I'm like, okay guys, the book's up. I'm going to bed. That was literally it. And I swear, if it weren't for my appointment with you guys, I would be probably half in the bag and or passed out on the sofa by now. And I'll check in with the numbers next week, because I'm still excited. Don't get me wrong.
Yeah.
But it's been a very different experience the second time, I have to say.
I guess it's like parents, would they have the first child, every time it cries, they're checking up on it, and then the second child, they're like, nah, it's fine.
You're speaking to a second child, a middle child right here, so you're tapping into my deepest insecurities.
Well, excellent. Well, good luck with it anyway. I hope it's a big success.
Oh, thanks so much.
All right, so, Chris, now, James had raced all these go-karts and stuff when you were his older brother. Did you ever, like, hop into one of his go-karts or race cars just to run around the track? Or have you ever tried any racing on your own? Or
you know, I mean, the story I tell of this was, you know, I was born, I'm in a racing family. And by that, I mean, you know, my father was super into racing. You know, he's from Leeds, you know, shout out another UK reference. he came over in the 70s, but you know, he was always into racing, and so, you know, that was his hobby. And so he tried to get his boys involved. You know, we have a sister as well, and she was sort of interested in it, but she kind of did her own thing. She was more into, I don't know, horses and stuff. But you know, initially I was very happy to go to the track and, you know, go to car shows and stuff. As much because it was like the boys hanging out, doing the boys thing. When he was in his 40s or something, he started racing. My dad, that is, started racing in this, sort of vintage, British sports car league, you know, this weekend warriors thing, which again is sort of referenced in the book. And it was at one of these races that someone else that my dad was racing with planted the seed in our minds to get James into driving go-karts. And James just kind of like lit up, right? It was like throwing a match on a pile of hay soaked in gasoline. And the second that James started racing, it was like any interest I had in racing kind of like evaporated. It was like, oh, okay, I guess that's his thing. And I went off and sort of was interested in other things for the longest time. It wasn't until much later that I sort of came back around to it. And so I mean, to make a short story long, no, not really. I never got into his go-karts. I never tried racing myself. I was interested in driving well on the roads. You know, my dad was always insistent that we would go to skid school and learn how to handle cars on the roads. I had a lot of fun doing, like a one-day racing academy at a track here in Ontario called Mo Sport, again, referenced in the book. I tell you, it's a lot of true stuff in there. But I remember that day I was there with a bunch of other, friends and colleagues of my father's. We had this track. We did this full day racing course, and we go out and James popped by for the afternoon session, and we're driving these Formula 2000s around this track at Mosport, the Bridgestone Racing Academy it was. And within 5 minutes on the track, it was like we're all still bunched up together, chasing each other, having a good time. And James is just on the other side of the track. Like, it's night and day. So, and at that point, I mean, he was, this was far from his days as an Indy driver, but the trying to drive against James is, it's like trying to play piano next to Beethoven or something. It's kind of not worth it. I leave that to James.
Fantastic. Now, Richard, you got one more question?
Yeah, one final question. I think we're going to start talking about some of the racing soon. But who's the best dancer in the family?
Ah, oh, you've hit a nerve. the thing about dancing is that when James took the Dancing with the Stars thing, none of us had ever seen him dance a single move. And I'd been to the odd dance club with him, in the years. I hadn't even seen him on the dance floor at his own after parties, at the Toronto Indy or anything like that. So we all thought it was going to be hilarious to watch him dance. So whereas I was like a drama theater kid in high school, right? So I always fancied myself sort of the dancer in the family. And so when James, starts drilling himself 8-10 hours a day, as he does with that spirit of his, and pulls out the performance that he did, he really stuck a knife in my chest because I guess I can never do that again. So I used to want to say it was myself, but I really don't think I can save it anymore.
All right, Chris, I wish you the best with the new book. I can't wait to read the new book. Myself, I've got it downloaded in my Kindle. Going to start reading it tomorrow. Quickly tell our listeners where we can find you on social media, where we can download the book, the first one and the second one, and then we'll start talking about the Grand Prix of Toronto.
Great. Well, you can find me Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. My handle on all of those is CM. Hinchcliffe, spelled just like James's name, so it's not too hard. And if you want to find the book right now, it's just on Amazon. But if you check out the website chasingcheckersbook.com, I'll be putting up links to the other sites as it becomes available there. You can join the reading the mailing list for other sorts of fun little tidbits. And and you can also get a free the first chapter of the first book is available for download there as well. So I suggest they start there.
Now, you are at the Grand Prix of Toronto signing books. Do you have plans to be at any other races this year? Going to be at Mid-Ohio or Sonoma or?
I had hemmed and hawed about Mid-Ohio. Sonoma is the one I really want to go to, and I still plan to try and make it to. Not least because, you know, as you mentioned, it may, you know, first of all, it's a great track. It's a lovely, you know, place to visit. And now it may be the last time they do it there. So I'm really hoping to make it to Sonoma. Otherwise, you know, next year, Toronto, obviously, I do my best to make it down to Indy for the month of May. But yeah, at the moment, that's all I've got on the books.
Okay. Well, fantastic. So, you know, if you wanted to get your signed copy, go to Sonoma and get
there
a nice glass of wine. You're in California wine country, so. But
actually, I will. Sorry, if I can just add a quick addendum to that, the signed copies can now not yet, but they will be available probably through the Indianapolis Motor Speedway store. James and I both will usually sign 100 books or something like that, and that they'll keep at their warehouse, so people can buy signed copies there. Now that's not yet. I don't know if they have any of the first book left, but if you can't make it to Sonoma, that is, there's always there's other options. Otherwise, send me an email. I'll send you one.
Yep. Excellent self promotion, man. You know, Christopher, you are a genius. So, but you spent your weekend at the Grand Prix of Toronto, where we saw James finish fourth, his teammate Wickens finish third. But man, it was an exciting race. You know, other than Dixon getting out front and just killing everybody else, but you know, there's a lot of bumping and banging. There's like a lot of like NASCAR stuff going on in the IndyCar race. At the same time, NASCAR race, we saw a really clean and kind of static race. So, but this Grand Prix of Toronto was a really fantastic race. They had a great crowd on hand, and they're hoping to continue to have a great crowd on hand with these Canadian stars such as James Hinchcliffe and Robert Wickens. So now, Chris, you know Wickens because him and your brother have been friends forever. You know, getting him into the IndyCar series, who would have thought he'd been this good, huh?
Well, we all did.
Now is James worried? Is James worried he's stealing his Canadian thunder?
Oh, not at all. Not at all. No, I mean, listen, I don't know if I'm ruining the game or something, but I know a lot of people want to make it seem like these boys are in competition with each other, but honestly, I mean, James and Robbie, just they get on so well. Robbie is like, I mean, he's a phenomenal driver, and we all knew that before he mm-hmm. came aboard. You don't get a job as a Mercedes factory test driver if you're no good, right? So having him over here is just, I mean, to me it's great for James. It's great having a teammate that he gets along with. It's great having a teammate with a similar driving style and with his own, you know, batch of experience that they can share with each other. You know, James is coaching him a little bit on how Indy is different from other stuff, and Robbie's got all his experience and just his raw talent that's not only sharing with James but pushing James. So yeah, I mean, sure, they're competitive. I mean, they get on the track and they both want to win. There's no doubt about that. But no, I mean, I think it's going to be nothing but good for both of them.
I agree. If you got two teammates who are willing to share information and to push one another to be better, I mean, you know, what better thing you have? You know, it's like we saw James win in Iowa. You know, a little bit of a surprise, but there he was right at the end where he needed to be. And Robbie has been. See, I've never called him Robbie till you did. No, I picked up on it, Chris.
Sorry.
But I mean, Wickens is like, he's like taken to IndyCars like a fish to water. So it's great to see those two guys. How long have they been friends? They're like go karts together, right?
Yeah, I mean, I want to say like 10. Since the age of 10 or something like that. I mean, there's a great picture of them that came out back when Robbie was first announced. of the two of them standing over a go-kart on a stand back in the day, probably at Goodwood Kartways or something. But it was around then. Like they've been friends for, you know, well over 15 years now. And I knew Robbie back then, but I've gotten to know him better since he's come back, and we've been, I've hung out with him a few times in the last couple of years, the nicest guy, but fierce competitor.
Oh, fierce competitor for sure, yeah. And it looks like his fiercest competitor has been Alexander Rossi, who's and IndyCar's trying to make a little bit of a rivalry between Rossi and Wickens, right? Or IndyCar's looking for a bad guy, right? So IndyCar needs a bad guy. Does IndyCar need a bad guy, Gray? Gray, you've been quiet all night. Gray, does IndyCar need a bad guy?
Yeah, everybody, you know, every circuit needs a bad guy, needs a villain. You know, the guy in the white hat, guy in the black hat, good versus evil. You know, it sells tickets.
I think the thing about characterizing Rossi as a bad guy is that I know him a little bit, and my impression is that he couldn't care less what you call him. He just wants to win.
You want
to call him, you know, he gets out there, and you hear it in the interviews. You see, there's no question. I mean, he's an aggressive driver. He's a very talented driver. I have nothing but respect for Alex as a driver. There's definitely moments where I watch races and I'm thinking, oh my God, he's gonna take everyone out, you know. And yeah. I don't know if it's luck or it's skill that there hasn't been a bigger incident. I mean, obviously that we know that first race. Where Robbie did not finish when he was leading.
St. Pete, yep. And neither one of them won.
There's racing and there's
neither
racing.
One of them won. The French guy won the race.
Well,
Sebastian Bourdais won the race, yeah. Go ahead, Greg.
My perspective comes from NASCAR, and of course, you know, open wheel racing is a little bit different discipline than stock cars are. When you've got fenders and things like that, you know, aggression takes a whole different tone, you know, so to speak. So, yeah, I think when we talk about good versus evil and the villain, you see more of that in NASCAR than you do in other forms of motorsports, because the way, you know, on oval tracks and things like that, it actually, the type of racing we do sort of lends itself to that. So, but yeah, but rivalries, I guess, to tone it down a little bit, rivalries are always good in motorsports. And I think it generates a lot of interest among the fans, and it's good. You know, when you've got different fan bases rooting for their guy against another guy, it makes the races more exciting.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, you need those storylines in there.
Yeah, so at the end of the day, Scott Dixon extended his points lead because his rivals kind of took one another. We had Will Power running into trouble, Ryan Hunter-Reay running into trouble, Rossi running into trouble. Richard, you think Dixon's going to run away with this thing?
Yeah.
Yeah? Okay, all right.
The guy's too good. Simple answer right there.
He's not going to blow a point lead. He's not going to give it away. That's for sure.
No, I mean, are they still doing the double points at Sonoma?
Yeah.
You know, if somebody decides to take him out at the first corner and whoever, you know, that's the only way that I can see him, you know, anything happening. But it was ironic, you know, at the start of the season, they were complaining that, you know, Ganassi, they were nowhere. They couldn't get the car dialed in. You know, the new aero kit, they were struggling massively. And it just shows that, you know, an experienced team that gets its head down and works through it and doesn't jump to knee-jerk reactions when something doesn't quite go their way, you know, eventually they'll prevail with it. And I think they've been fantastic this year. I mean, it's probably more impressive what they've done than what you've seen in the past when one car or one manufacturer dominates it. The way they progress is brilliant.
Where do you want me to put this?
It hasn't brilliant, actually. I'm not sure where Gray's wife wanted to put this, but
I could guess a few places.
I'm sorry, Gray. But so Dixon is about running away with this thing, but as long as we've watched IndyCar racing, we know that Dixon is the guy that'll jump up and steal it from you when you think you have it in your hand. Ask Will Power, you know. Ask Montoya. Ask Castro Neves. Yeah. So, is there anybody there that can jump up and steal it from Dixon? Christopher Hinchcliffe, I'm going to ask you.
Well, I mean, I might first point out, as a wise man once said, that given all the variables on a racetrack, it's the most likely place for miracles to happen.
Yeah, I read that in a book somewhere. Very good book, by the way.
Yeah, whoever wrote that must know what they're talking about.
Yeah, it sounds genius. No, listen, I mean, it's true. I mean, it's true. I mean, there's no question he's got a points lead. There is no question that Dixie is a phenom, quite possibly the best driver out there, if not ever. You know, and I say, you know, with all due respect to my brother and all the other drivers, my brother would be the first to admit that. But, you know, I wouldn't count Joseph out. I wouldn't count Alex out. You know, I wouldn't even count Will and Hunter Ray out. It's there's still plenty of racing left to do. So I mean, I wouldn't put my money on anyone just yet.
Good advice. Yep, this is way too early to call. Now, Richard, you have some inside info on McLaren.
Well, I was wondering if our guest has any inside info on. You know, talking about Scott Dixon, you know, there's rumours that, you know, he's been approached by McLaren, you know, for next year or Alonso. You know, it's strange how, you know, probably 2 months ago, around the time of Indy, you know, it was a done deal. Alonso was going to be driving an Indy car next year with a McLaren-badged Andretti car. And, you know, for the last couple of months, it's all gone very quiet. And, you know, wondering, you know, what the talk in the nearer the series is.
I mean, honestly, I mean, I don't know any more than I think you guys do. But then again, if I did, I'm not sure I'd be able to say anything. At this point, as far as I know, I mean, there are rumors, you know, there are talks, I think, but, no, I don't know anything more than that. Sorry to disappoint.
There you go. Yep. Yep. I don't know why you would ask a book author about McLaren rumors.
What?
But... Oh man!
Than we are.
I love you guys, dudes. We got about 4 minutes left in the show, and I'd be remiss if I didn't mention that Seth and I spent our weekend at Kentucky Speedway to see Martin Truex Jr. nail down one more win. To take him within one of the other two guys that have won five with his Harvick and Kyle Busch. So, Seth, we got about 3 minutes left in the show. Just run us through Kentucky real quick. It was a really clean race, which does not sell tickets.
Well, at the same time, it was pretty shocking to me to see some teams that are usually powerhouse teams playing the strategy game very early in the race just to try to keep up with Truex, Kyle Busch, and Harvick. Not to beat them, but to keep up with them. That's the dominant season the top three drivers have had.
Yeah, Jimmy Johnson did the two tires, stayed up front until they passed him, but that only... The two-tire strategy only works on a short green flag run, and Kentucky had some long, long, long green flag runs.
Although, to be fair, in the truck race,
we're talking about the cup race.
Left off with 40 to go, took no tires, and went on to win.
That's the cup. That's the truck race, though. Talk about the cup race.
I know.
Okay, yeah. So you know, Kentucky is. This is the interesting thing, right? So back to our circling back to talk about IndyCar. Somebody, a friend of mine, asked the president of Kentucky Speedway, you know, what are your thoughts on hosting IndyCar back at Kentucky? And the dude says, we would love to have IndyCar back at Kentucky, but our phone hasn't rang. So, I mean, the Kentucky right now has, they've got the you know, the July Cup date. They've got the fall Xfinity date that nobody comes. They could use one more.
They don't have that
date anymore. So there you go. So they've got one date. They could use IndyCar back in the schedule, but IndyCar is going to Laguna Seca. They're dropping Sonoma. Maybe Texas is off the board, but Kentucky would love to have IndyCar back. They're just waiting for the phone to ring. And on that note, we are at 58 minutes and 39 seconds. So where are we racing next week, Gray?
We are racing in Loudoun, New Hampshire this weekend.
All right. Seth, who do you like for Loudoun?
I think Martin Truex Jr. will go back-to-back for the first time in his Cup career.
Okay. Richard, who you like for Loudoun?
Kyle Larson.
Gray?
Kyle Busch.
Christopher, you get to pick a NASCAR driver for the race.
Yeah, I'll go with Kyle Busch. Last one I heard. That's the center of my insight.
That'll work. So, and then IndyCar is going to be at Mid-Ohio. So who do you like from Mid-Ohio?
Ooh,
Christopher. I've asked Christopher first.
I'm thinking it's a Hinchcliffe Wickens 1-2. That's what I'm
okay. Hey, why not? Yep. Seth, who you like?
I'll go with Hunter Ray.
Right, Hunter Ray. Okay, Richard.
Ooh, Robert Wickens.
And Gray.
Will Power. He can't keep a good man down. He needs to bounce back.
And I'm gonna pick James Hinchcliffe just to appease my guest, who's a
man after my heart.
You know what, sure. Chris, you've been a fantastic guest tonight. You're the first guest that has stayed on for the full hour and not jumped off after the interview. So,
it's been a treat.
You know what, you have been a treat. You absolutely have. So, but we are out of time. I want to thank you, Gray, Seth, Richard. I want to thank everybody that listens in. I want to thank iHeartRadio for hosting us. I want to thank the Hoobazoo Radio Network and say, guys, we'll be on next week. Next week, our guest will be Jeremy Millis from the Alexander Rossi team, the chief engineer. So tune in for that for sure. But in the meantime, man, get on Amazon and buy Chasing Checkers Acceleration. You will love it, I promise. Good night.
WHOOBAZOO.com. WHOOBAZOO.com. Enter website.